Hi, I'm Margaret Preston, president of Power Over Parkinson's, and today, in conjunction with our POP Profile series, we have Dr. Alberto Espe, professor, director, and endowed chair of the James J. and Joan A. Gardner Center for the Parkinson's Center, Disease Center at the University of Cincinnati. Dr. Espe, thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm delighted to be here, Margaret. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, we're excited. So we've got a lofty agenda, so I'd like to jump right in and hit some areas of your research at a high level to share with our listeners.
Absolutely. Happy to do so.
First of all, I'd like to start at a high level. If you could just share with our listeners what the Cincinnati Cohort Biomarker Program, or the CCBP, is.
Yeah, the CCBP is our attempt at acting on the principle that not two individuals are alike, that the form in which we age varies. We've been saying to ourselves that not two of us ever quite age the same way, have the same brand of Parkinson's. Everybody's blazing their own trail. But then we've also kept on trying to find a biomarker of Parkinson's and a treatment of Parkinson's. And as you know, those two things can't be true if, in fact, Parkinson's isn't a single construct, but a different expression in different individuals, then there will have to be different drivers for different individuals. That's what the CCBP is about, is to essentially walk the talk. It's the first biomarker that is studying aging in the individuals that are affected with Parkinson's and also with other neurodegenerative conditions, because we don't know where Parkinson's ends and Alzheimer's begins, or when Alzheimer's ends and frontotemporal dementia begins. All of these constructs have been created at a time when we really couldn't probe living individuals with biological measures, with bioassays. Now we can. So now we can begin to tease out who is aging with, say, Parkinson's due to what. And we're therefore using this as a platform to identify the individuals that today might have a therapy that slows or reverses their disease, if we knew, of course, what that disease expression in them is. So perhaps it is best thought of as a platform to matching therapies already available that we've had for over four decades to people who are biologically best susceptible to benefiting from them.
That makes sense. And in reading your papers and research, and perhaps this next question is applicable or not, but is it safe to say that through the CCBP, are we really stripping away the confinements of almost the nomenclature of the disease type, and instead looking more at patient biology across the neurodegenerative diseases rather than being more siloed within the diseases?
That's correct. Yes, we're assuming that the labels that we've used to given someone a framework for what they have, Parkinson's disease, is really a placeholder diagnosis. Yeah. We don't really know, when we're saying Parkinson's disease, what we mean for the individuals who are saying Parkinson's too, because we know that there isn't a script that everyone follows. Everyone is different.
Right.
So this is a way, as you're nicely putting it, to break down the silos of our labels. So the way that's actually operationalized in our biomarker program, CCBP, is that while we're having patients with Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and other neurodegenerative conditions, and most of them at the moment have Parkinson's, just by virtue of the largest bulk of our clinic, the analysis are blinded to their clinical diagnosis and to their many aspects of behavior that we measure. What we're determining is, where are they abnormal biologically? Okay. And so we're looking for the biological outliers, so to speak, as well as those who have an assay that determines somehow a range of abnormality that then would predict they could benefit from something that we're already interested in repurposing. And there have been over 20 therapies that have been tried over the last four decades. We're concentrated on the top five at the moment that have the greatest potential for repurposing. We are in the process of understanding who the best candidates for those therapies are. So by being blinded to what the diagnosis is and just being looking at using the biology as what we call the independent variable, we can then determine the needles in the haystack that would in fact be targetable with things that we already have available for them.
It's so interesting. And it certainly in reading your research shifted my mindset of kind of taking away that labor of that diagnosis, because it almost confines you into thinking what would come next versus thinking more on a level playing field just in terms of biology. So thank you. You've kind of shifted my mindset in thinking about the disease and the assignment of disease. And sometimes that's confining.
Indeed. Thank you.
As we conclude on the CCBP, share with our listeners an overview of what the patient experience looks like and where patients go if they can learn more about the study and perhaps participate.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, so the CCBP is really a once a year commitment. It is a variety of different tests that we're doing. The most important source of biological information is the blood. So the only invasive, so to speak, component to it is the blood draw.
Okay.
We are keenly interested in storing that. And so we have a bank, it's called the biobank, that stores the blood. It also stores urine, and we're extracting genetic information from the stools, mm-hmm. genetic information about the microbiome, which lives within us. So blood, urine, and stool are the three tissues. The stool sometimes is hard for people, and so that could not be done if it's difficult. Those are the sources of information. This is a once a year commitment. So the first year is the one that's about most intense, so 3 hours or so. Mm-hmm. Subsequent years is less, is an hour or under, could be. So it's less taxing. As I mentioned, no elements that relate to the investigation that are invasive with the except the blood draw. There is a website called ccbpstudy.com, ccbpstudy1word.com, that we're very proud of, has a lot of information, not only about what exactly are we doing with each of these visits,
right.
but why we're doing this. And the why is so important. It's kind of the reason we tell people when they're meeting us for the first time. And if we diagnose Parkinson's, we say that's the what. This is what this is.
Right.
But we don't know why this happened, because the most important question is to answer why
mm-hmm.
did this happen to me? And that's a critical question that this study is meant to answer. So this study right now is a study, but in the future, it probably will become standard of care. The same platform that, say, oncologists are using to define, say, the type of breast cancer individuals affected, right? The oncologists don't say, well, this is breast cancer, trust me. They say, well, this is breast cancer. I have no idea what it means to you. I would have to do these different tests to be able to understand what specific condition do you fall into. Mm-hmm. And essentially, how is it that we are going to define the treatment that will be applicable to you? Until then, we might give you a few things to help you feel better if we need to, but really we're going to wait for this layer of information to be able to define what type of breast cancer you have. That's what we hope to, through CCBP, accomplish with people with Parkinson's, is to say, you have Parkinson's, we have no idea what it means to you. We'll need to do these different acquisitions of information,
mm-hmm.
which is what the study is collecting,
right.
to determine the brand of Parkinson's you have and to determine if you are a candidate for one of the therapies that we have already available for repurposing. Meanwhile, here's levodopa to make you feel better.
Yes, that's fantastic. So
that's sort of where we're trying to go with this. And in a way, it shouldn't be thought of as revolutionary, because as I am just alluding, this is something that is happening in other fields mm-hmm. of medicine.
Sure.
It is just we have been rather delayed in adopting the principles of what others have referred to as precision medicine. This is a form of deploying precision medicine for people living with Parkinson's.
And I'd like to note, we will certainly include that link for folks to check out on the end of this presentation, included in the video. So we will definitely get that out. I'd like to move on to another area of your research, including on-off times, which I know is so applicable to many of our listeners. Spend a few times before we get into the research defining what on-off times. I think we, you know, everyone talks about it, everyone throws that language around, but define on-off time for our listeners.
Sure. Well, let me start by saying that the on and off language were created by clinicians like me that were interested in trying to prove that certain interventions were going to extend the duration of benefit of anti-Parkinsonian therapy. So essentially dopaminergic medications aimed at enhancing the concentration of dopamine in the brain. Off and on are as if people live in two stages, and that's not true. It's an artificial construct that simply means when people are predominantly under the benefits of, say, levodopa, and levodopa is the one medication that can turn people on. It essentially means it relieves the symptoms that made them be recognized as having Parkinson's. Because levodopa is so effective, when it wears off, the half-life of it is about 90 minutes. So anything about over 90 minutes is going to be the brain buffering how much it could by taking as much into the brain, storing it, and then releasing it slowly. In many cases, once the on turns on, the buffering capacity of the brain is such that even if we dose it 3 or 4 times a day, there is no wearing off. But sometimes wearing off does occur. And wearing off essentially means that the levodopa benefit decreases. When the symptoms of Parkinson's reemerge is what we refer to as an off. So on is when the full benefits are there. Off is when the benefits have worn off. As you can imagine, there is a shade of gray for both the on and the off. So no one really switches quite off to on, off to on. Right. That doesn't happen, but that's kind of how we use it. Mm-hmm. So we think that on is where we need to get with patients. And in many ways, on off fluctuations, which is what happens sometimes with the therapy, is a bit of a price of success in the sense that off only occurs in individuals who have achieved an on.
Right.
And if we ask someone who's had Parkinson's for, say, 6, 7 years, do you ever wear off? And the question is off, what does that even mean? Mm-hmm. That probably means that the joy of an on, has mm-hmm. never been acquired. Mm-hmm. And so we then think that most of these individuals, if in fact they have Parkinson's, have been undertreated.
Okay.
So
that was a very good explanation. I think it sounds like certainly the goal, of course, is to extend that on time and to have it as consistent and long as possible.
Exactly.
So as we talk about our goals with on-off times, I'd love to jump into your research about in this area that you're conducting with Parkinson's disease on-off times, specifically the subcutaneous infusion of levodopa, which is really fascinating. So share with our listeners about that research.
Yeah, absolutely. So as the normal state of dopamine stimulation in the brain is what we call tonic, which means it's continuous. And the replacement, on the other hand, is the opposite, is phasic or intermittent, because as I mentioned, levodopa only lasts about 90 minutes. Everything mm-hmm. beyond 90 minutes is the brain trying to expand that effect. There has then been a longstanding interest in trying to approach what is physiologic, what is normal. If the normal state is for the brain to be bathing on dopamine at all times, and the abnormal or artificial state is for the brains to go through peaks and valleys, then an infusion system would be technically the way to get there. We have often explained to patients that levodopa is to Parkinson's what insulin is to diabetes. We, of course, want to give people the insulin as much as they need and in a regular fashion as they can. The same principle should apply to Parkinson's. We try to ensure that they would have the levels of levodopa given at the sweet spot where they are essentially as normal as possible. But it hasn't been possible with the oral interventions. And so this is where the subcutaneous infusion of levodopa, which is the latest treatment, we call it Neuroderm 0612. This is sort of the levodopa formulation given continuously using a subcutaneous infusion. So essentially, it looks like a patch, as if it were transdermal, but isn't, because the patch has a little needle that goes into the fatty tissue underneath the skin. And then the other end of the patch has a little catheter that connects to a syringe that is attached to a pump that then delivers the liquid formulation of levodopa into the subcutaneous, the fatty tissue. And it does so at a level that hopefully relieves most of the symptoms. Sometimes it requires additional levodopa orally, but in general, the idea is then to go from the fluctuations that we typically would see with the oral treatments, immediate release carbidopa, levodopa being the more common, to a much more steady levels, which then means that the on periods will be stretched out longer, the off periods will be shortened and also rendered shallower, right? Because if you are lifting the floor, so to speak, many people have off periods, they are not going to be as deep as they used to be. Okay. That's the principle of this therapy. And it's very similar to another therapy. So this one is the one I've been part of, led by Neuroderm. And there is another similar system by AbbVie. And these two systems probably will be available within the next 6 months, certainly, probably before the year, I would hope would be the case. Oh,
that's wonderful. And what hope to give to folks as they kind of watch that come out and be, you know, tangible to themselves, to have that more level playing field that everyone's striving for with the disease.
And I should say quickly that there is a third infusion system, but this thing, this would not be of levodopa, but of apomorphine. No relationship with morphine is one of the most effective therapies. It's considered equipotent, equally potent to levodopa. And we have it as an Apoking, is an injectable formulation that is used for rescue to get people out of an off. Mm-hmm. But this is going to be an infusion system also, the same principles, delivering it in a more continuous fashion, titrated to the level that's most therapeutic for them. So that so I'm adding this just to emphasize that within a year, we'll have potentially options. Three infusion systems.
Yes.
And so we will finally live up to that promise that that we will have something like the insulin pump, mm-hmm. but for people with Parkinson's.
That's very exciting. Thank you for taking the time to share that.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Moving on to another area of your research regarding investigating extended release oral levodopa, IPX203, and its efficacy on motor fluctuations. I'd like to jump in, much as we did with on-off times before we get started, spend a few minutes just defining motor fluctuations for our listeners.
Yes, motor fluctuations are the alternating changes between on and off, with on usually complicated by dyskinesia. So it's usually on with dyskinesia, and off, of course, related to the reemergence of tremor, but potentially with other manifestations such as gait difficulties, freezing, or falls. Correction or the attempts at correct the off periods with adjustments in the oral carbidopa, levodopa in people who are more fluctuating is that if we increase the individual dose, then we might reduce the off, but we might then do so at the expense of increasing the dyskinesia, the extra movements that people have during the on period, then that would be essentially trading one problem with another.
Sure.
And sometimes the balance is not good. So IPX 203 is an effort to stretch the time in which it lasts the on. Mm-hmm. And because the principle is a relatively slow release, so normal carbidopa, levodopa gives a peak and then it wears off quickly after. This one doesn't have quite the same peak. It's a little less and then it stays on a little longer and then wears off at a later time point. So you are then hoping with this new formulation to get to a coverage of the so-called on time with mm-hmm. less dyskinesia because it will have less of a peak mm-hmm. and yet less of an off time too because it will stretch out longer. So that's the principle of IPX 203 as it relates to motor fluctuations. So this study was done in people who had motor fluctuations, so on with dyskinesia that prevented the optimization any further of the off periods, the reduction of the off periods. And so that's what made candidates ideal for this study.
Okay. So what place would this medication have in the treatment of PD? Are we thinking this would be a first line added in after a period of time, a component or, you know, partner with another medication? Kind of talk to us about that.
Great question. For people who have motor fluctuations, there are several options. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the most important is adjustments in the oral carbidopa levodopa. Mm-hmm. The new medication would then apply when the optimization efforts have failed, mm-hmm. when we've been essentially spinning our wheels in terms of increasing or decreasing the dosage. So usually, it's increasing the dosage or decreasing the interdose mm-hmm. interval, meaning shortening the times between doses. Sometimes the times are already short enough. People may be doing this every 3 hours and shortening the interval less than that becomes impractical. By the way, that's the whole concept of the infusions as we discussed earlier, is as if people were doing it on an hourly basis, right?
Yeah.
Which would not be possible to do, yes. But that's what the infusion mm-hmm. in essence does. Mm-hmm. So so for the other options are, as I mentioned, beyond increasing the individual dose, shortening the intervals, is to add medications that could prop up the system, such as, for instance, add a COMT inhibitor. COMT inhibitors. COMT is an enzyme that has to do with the breakdown of levodopa. So if you inhibit that breakdown, then you have more of it. And the medications are entacapone and opicapone. Opicapone is a new one. Opicapone is taken once a day, and entacapone is taken with each dose. Another approach would be to add MAO-B inhibitors. Selegiline and rasagiline are the more common ones. There is the opportunity of using a new medication called estradefiline, okay. potentially. Mm-hmm. And you can use dopamine agonists, although dopamine agonists have fallen a bit in rough consideration by us because as we age with Parkinson's, dopamine agonists tend to have a risk-benefit ratio that renders them a bit unfavorable with the potential for impulse control disorders, meaning compulsive gambling, excessive shopping, et cetera, as well as excessive sleepiness, which can be problematic. And sometimes people have cognitive difficulties, hallucinations, leg swelling. So there is a variety of side effects that make us less likely to use them. So when you have thought of all these options, one option in the future, once IPX 203 will be approved, and I don't know what the name of it will be once it gets commercially available, will be an option. This would be an extended release formulation. We have one such product in the market called Rytary. Is also in the company that made or sponsored the study of IPX 203 is the same one, Amneal. And so Rytary is an option. And the thought is that even though the trial did not compare Rytary to this new drug, compare this new drug to immediate release carbidopa levodopa, that this will be an improvement upon what Rytary does. So this will become then the longest acting extended release formulation of levodopa as an option for people who are experiencing motor fluctuations.
so much hope as we reflect on the last, like you said, 4 or 5 decades of really the same therapy, but so much hope coming down in the next year or so with other options for people to kind of level things out a little bit more and take control and ultimately live their life, because of course that's the goal.
Yeah.
I'd like to move on to more general Parkinson's disease questions as we talk about the barriers to treatment advancements and, you know, basically the trajectory of the disease. At this point, what would you say is the biggest barrier in advancements and treatments, as well as ultimately unlocking the cure to Parkinson's disease?
Yes, probably the most important question. I think the key barrier is our approach to what we mean by Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. Forever, we've meant a clinical pathologic entity. And by clinical pathologic entity, I mean that there are a variety of features, all of which are considered part of Parkinson's if the pathology, Lewy bodies, Lewy neurites, we call them collectively Lewy pathology, are there in some way or another. So if you have these clinical features of a wide diversity, in fact, increasing diversity, tremor, rigidity, stiffness, gait impairment, cognitive difficulties, hallucination, mm-hmm. and you have the pathology, that's called Parkinson's. And that is too wide a construct, and it's too diverse biologically. So I think the key roadblock to getting beyond symptomatic therapies, the kinds of things we've discussed just right. previously, which are to boost the system, mm-hmm. to replenish the dopamine that patients aren't manufacturing enough of, is to get to the source of the problem, why they aren't manufacturing enough dopamine. That's so important. But to get to that level, we need to understand that it won't be the same approach to what we've been doing for symptomatic therapies. For symptomatic therapies, we've been trying to just lump everyone.
Yes.
And it's worked okay, because the one thing that people are properly lumped into a bucket is the fact that they do have dopamine deficiency. And so if we correct dopamine deficiency, that can help them. Yes. But lumping is not good for precision medicine principles, mm-hmm. where splitting is required. We need to figure out who has what, mm-hmm. biologically speaking. And until we get to that point from a cultural perspective, we will continue having trial after trial of disease-modifying interventions, mm-hmm. therapies that presumably have a protective effect on the biology of a model of Parkinson's disease, that will have nothing much to show for them at all, that we will continue having negative trial after negative trial. Mm-hmm. It's been the story of our lives. Unfortunately, we have these amazing, exciting molecules. Really, they do quite a bit of work, and you can tell that by virtue of the results that you have from animal models. Mm-hmm. But then once we have that amazing result in an animal model, we say, well, we're going to translate that to humans. We're going to now, since it cures Parkinson's in mice, I'm sure it will do so the same in everyone we call Parkinson's in humans. And we never have stopped to say, well, what I mean, let's think of what is it, that precise mechanism that might have made a difference here. And let's figure out who have in the universe of Parkinson's that mechanism at play that would then be best targeted with this therapy. Mm-hmm. We've skipped that. We've said, no, if it works in this animal model, it will work for Parkinson's disease. Not otherwise specified.
Right.
And of course it doesn't. It never does, because it can't. Mm-hmm. It can't be that we're going to have a therapy that will work for everyone, mm-hmm. because it modifies something in the lysosomal receptor, because it enhances the mitochondrial function, or because it does something with the proteasome, or whatever the mechanism it may be. We need to start thinking that none of the mechanisms are at play in everyone. If something is too common across a large group of people and becomes a biomarker of Parkinson's disease, it can never be a marker that's relevant to each individual affected, because it's too common, right? Dopamine deficiency is not a cause of Parkinson's, it's a consequence of Parkinson's, because it's too common, mm-hmm. across everyone. Mm-hmm. So that's why correcting dopamine deficiencies doesn't cure anybody.
Yeah,
it helps people. But to get to the cures, we need to get to a point where we are able to distinguish what is it that makes each individual people with Parkinson's different from one another. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do with CCPP. We're trying to act on the principle precisely that we need to figure out why everyone is affected uniquely, and why is it that no one is following the same script, right?
I was going to tie it back to what you noted with the CCBP as to the why. You have to get to the why, and everybody's why is different.
Everyone's why is different. Well said.
That was beautifully explained. Thank you for sharing that and your thoughts on that question, because it is the question of the lifetime for the disease. You know, as we talk about the symptoms of the disease, so many people think it's synonymous with a tremor, those just as they think about Parkinson's disease, but there's so much more, as we know, so many facets, so many intricacies of the disease. If you could shine a light on one lesser known symptom of the disease, what would it be?
I would say that the lesser known symptoms of the disease are the ones that we can't see, but patients can feel greatly. Mm-hmm. So usually depression, mm-hmm. fatigue, anxiety is very common, mm-hmm. lightheadedness or foggy mindedness, sometimes constipation can be quite common, sweating abnormalities can happen, loss of sense of a smell is a very common one too. Those are the ones that perhaps we think of as being under-recognized. And the reason they're under-recognized because we're highly visual. We mm-hmm. make sense of that which we can see. And so sometimes we see people that look good, but they don't feel good. Mm-hmm. I say, well, but you should look good because yeah. look how your scores are great, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of what we can
right.
put a number to. And yet they don't feel good because they have anxiety.
Yeah.
In fact, anxiety is one of the most common non-motor manifestations of wearing off. When people go from a good level of treatment to wearing off, they might not show that as a tremor or as stiffness or a slow walking. They might show that or experience that as anxiety.
Yes.
And so this is not just a motor disorder. It's a the term neuropsychiatric disorder is used to be, but essentially it's a brain disorder that can have motor and non-motor manifestations.
Right.
And the non-motor tend to be less well addressed than the motor ones, I think, just simply because of the bias that we all have by paying attention more to the things we see and less to the things we don't or can't see.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Dr. Espe, I can't thank you enough for your time today. I'd like for you to share with our listeners, I know we mentioned the CCBP website, but if there's any other information or where folks can go to learn more about your research and the work being done at the Gardner Center, feel free to share, direct them at this time.
Well, anyone that wishes to ask specific questions can reach to me directly. My email is my first name, that last name, alberto.espe@uc.edu. Mm-hmm. The website has a lot of information there that we've been putting into that answer a number of questions. But I know that there are always questions that are relevant to people in a way that perhaps we have not emphasized. So I'm happy always to entertain questions like that. There is a book called Brain Fables that I wrote to talk about the culture as a whole. And I invite people to consider checking that out. It's a book that is now due for an update in some levels just because of new things we've learned. But the Sure. principles are still there. It was written in 2020. Mm-hmm. So a couple of years old now. But at any rate, I'm always happy. I learn a lot from my patients, and that is the source of all of the wisdom we claim to have. We do research not because we're researchers. We do research simply because it's a means to an end. The end is to help people, and research is only there to answer the questions that we have not been able to answer for our patients. And so that's why we have CCBP, and that's why we have a number of other research endeavors. And mm-hmm. so I'm delighted to help in any way I can. So tell your audience that I'm available for any questions, any concerns that they may have and they wish to run by me personally.
Well, thank you for the good work you're doing for the Parkinson's community, Dr. Espe, and thank you for sharing your time with Power of Parkinson's today.
You're very welcome, Margaret. Thank you for inviting me.